Mark Mullinax here. Welcome back to Power for the Peaceful, our podcast class that slow walks through the 81 verses of Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. Today, verse 44, thirst.
When you listen to the ground and you put your roots down, you can hear what she says if you're listening. When you listen to the ground and you put your roots down, you can hear what she says if you're listening. The sweet sound of the river as she moves over the stones. The same song that the blood in your body sings as it weaves around your bones. When you're listening, when you're listening, are you listening?
Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through or steal. Where your treasure is, there will your heart also be. Jesus.
Welcome back, everyone. Good to have you aboard today. My reader today is Rongsei Chang, who describes herself this way.
Hello, this is Rongsei Chang. I'm a resident of Mars Hill, North Carolina.
Together, we hope to find some new meaning, or meaning for today, about how we relate to things and to privilege. Our relationships to things and privilege can be blinding bling to those who seek a way, that is, a Tao, through this life. You know as well as I that our lives fill up with siren calls and shouts for attention to the things that may be nice but needless, great but in the end greedy. Today's verse is one that cuts through the crap and addresses our serenity and contentment that predate our thirsts. Ever had one of those non-serene days or a malcontented time period in your life? Seems like nothing's going right. We feel off target, off balanced, like some wheel on a shopping cart that's out of round. Such times and events are the kind we hope do not repeat themselves. We'd rather have one day of serenity and harmony, perhaps much more than many days of trying to find our way among the maze of the 10,000 things. What if it's all about focus? A camera, just a little bit out of focus, ruins the entire picture. But get the focus right, and the view is great. One small thing, out of round, out of harmony, off balance, affects the big picture. But it's just one thing wrong. The camera only takes the picture we tell it to. It is us that controls the shutter. And if our timing, our balance, or our attitude is just a little bit out of round, a little bit off balance, seems like the whole experience is somehow diminished and out of focus. Now, if we're lucky enough, we might start to reflect on what's wrong. And sooner or later, if we are curious enough about why we are off balance, and if we get quiet enough, the answer will come. Ah, it's my focus on something, some idea, some desire, some action that I, and only I, want. It's some undisciplined desire, some willful plan. And then I start to settle for something exterior, to replace something interior. I have lowered my sights, though. I've lowered my expectations, my ceiling, and things get all constricted, complicated, and out of round. So the teaching in this verse 44 is probably not new to any of us. No matter our spiritual tradition or ancestry, I'm betting that you will bring some powerful spiritual memory to this verse that could help us guide us away from pursuing material desires. We learn somewhere along the way that what is essential, as the Little Prince book puts it, is invisible to the eye. But those most essential ideas are still real, even if they are undetectable by our normal senses. Maybe the more we hold on to or value the seen, the heard, the felt, that is, the detectable, the more we suffer. But it takes a lot of willpower even to recognize one's ignorance. Ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance is illness and a luxury. As verse 71 will teach us in the near future, the agony of ignorance is called. Knowing one's ignorance is healthy. Not knowing, but pretending to, is disease. And only those who grow tired of their ignorance can awaken and go free. Well, how does one get tired of ignorance? How do we actually learn about those temporary things like material goods or that do not satisfy, that have no future, and do not fulfill? How do we recognize them for what they truly are? And then how will we develop a will to expose them and allow them to die from the exposure? Well, it's past time for our verse reading. Rangsei is going to read our passage. Please note that in all my translation of Tao Te Ching, this verse 44 is the only place where I added something that was not in the original Chinese text. There are three parts to this verse, and each one begins with one added by me word. First one is questions, second discussion, and third solution. I thought, as a professor, that this would be an appropriate way to help readers frame this verse. Rangsei?
Verse 44, the answer to the test. Questions. Reputation or life, which has the longer future? Body or wealth, which would you give up first? Gain or loss, which distresses more? Discussion. Extravagance is the purpose of love. Generosity is the reason for wealth. The more you hoard privilege, the more you want it. Is this serenity? Is it worthwhile? Solution. You have it all, even now. A contented life is not a deprived one. Keep cool to the extent you can. Interrupt your nonsense. You will. Never lose the grace. You will be forever safe and always at home.
When you're listening, when you're listening, are you listening? When you're listening, when you're listening, are you listening?
Clearly, the more we own, have, or manage, the more we are enslaved to this more. More, more, and still more is our anthem. In our times, at least, and perhaps throughout most of the world, we think more is better. The one who dies with the most toys wins, right? Larger, more, bigger. Why do we feel and then use these external measures for the measure of a person? Why do we feel this need for something external to us in order to make our internal self seem somehow more important? More secure? Is it a basic insecurity? If so, is this insecurity caused or aided by the culture itself? It seems to me that a person's worth is more about who they are, not what they own, and how they, well, love and change the world for the better. The thing is about stuff. We stuff ourselves with things. We run ourselves into debt just buying larger houses and then renting storage places to manage our lives, our overextended lives, caused by the things that we have bought and overbought. The more what we own owns us. We acquire, 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 meaning that the more we own, the more we have to manage it. Spending time, precious time, to manage it all. Here's the thing, though. What we own and have to manage has an opportunity cost. When we own more than we need, we don't have the bandwidth for many other portions of our life. Said another way, when we do one thing or own one thing, we haven't the time to be present for other opportunities. There's only so much we can manage in a 24-hour-a-day life. Too much ownership is a tax. For whatever I own or do means I won't have the resources or time to own or to do something else. A something else that could be more helpful and less selfish. Speaking from my own experience, when I own too much, I have to make space for it, ensure it, dust it off, clean it, manage it. My days become full of managing my stuff instead of doing something more valued with my time and resources. The more I own, the more I am owned, ruled, that is, by other things. For at the heart of ourselves, like on the day we were born, there was, originally, a no place, a no thing, a desireless place, a place clear and clean of ego-driven desires. But then, somewhere along the way, unmanaged desires began, and they take us into some fruitless search for our true selves, but in all the wrong places, when no searching was ever needed in the first place. Our true self is always there, always with us. It needs no augmentation by things, by stuff, by desires, by these insatiable thirsts for something else, for something more.
Solution. You have it all, even now. A contented life is not a deprived one.
But there is something more insidious going on with our unchecked, unmanaged desires to own, acquire, accumulate, possess. It's this application of that opportunity cost just mentioned. For when we stuff ourselves full of desires, thinking that this is the best, fullest, and most successful life possible, what happens is that by concentrating on acquiring, we develop lowered capacities to concentrate on other things. Thus, our bad habits, our karma, follows us home like a lost dog. Thinking that we're adding to and building up and maintaining some self, our true self, we actually are not. We just accumulate piles and piles of bad karma, fueled by habits which take lifetimes to overcome. Ever consider that we can actually waste lifetimes by building up and maintaining crap that has no future? Which means we build up and maintain a sense of self, a sense of the I, my, me, mine, mind. Which means a life surrounded by self and its desires, which means artificial living that has no real future, which means it will take a long time for decrease or neutralization of that accumulated bad karma by wanting ourself to be other than it already is. The Buddha's second noble truth is very relevant here. Rangse will read a quote from the Buddha in a second, but note in the second sentence that she reads, the phrase renews being. Renews being is the renewal of the bad karma of thinking or desiring oneself as larger or other than one already is. To renew being is not good news, but the worst news in a Buddhist sensibility. Rangse?
What is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? It is craving which renews being and is accompanied by relish and lust, relishing this and that. In other words, craving for sensual desires, craving for being, craving for non-being, or things that have no real existence. But where does this craving arise and flourish? Wherever there is what seems lovable and gratifying, thereon it arises and flourishes.
Of course, the Buddha's spiritual program is to identify the causes of suffering. The number one cause of suffering is to maintain a sense of self, to develop a thirst for maintaining oneself. That is, doing things for recognition, padding one's resume with accomplishments that we do to increase egotistical self-worth, maintaining one's idea of a self, insert your name here, that needs to survive. But it's all a pretense, like that I am a separate, identifiable self, that I have a past and a future, that my skin is the boundary of my self. Suffering in Buddhism is this maintenance of a false pretense, that there's this permanent mark somewhere that I have to maintain. Instead, There are these streams of awareness that happen to merge within this body that I cannot even call mine. These streams are called skandhas, S-K-A-N-D-H-A-S, a Buddhist term. One stream of skandha is the awareness of the form of something, like a chair. Another, separate stream is the awareness of emotionally sensing things, like the feelings I get when I see a comfortable chair after a long day. The third stream is the perception of things as divided into convenient classes or categories, like identifying chairs by my past experiences of using them before. The fourth stream that I feel is real are the mental formations or opinions my brain makes about the desirability of things, like what a comfortable chair or uncomfortable chair feels like. And I develop preferences, and then I call these preferences mine. The fifth skandha stream of consciousness, and these all these skandhas are flowing in different volumes and strengths. This fifth skandha stream of consciousness is the being aware of things in the world, like chairs in general. These five streams are just mental processes that we reify. They are thoughts that we make into things about which we form our own identities as somehow permanent, unchanging, and fixed, when we're actually flows of different consciousnesses that happen to merge in a being we temporarily call Mark for 80 years or so. This is suffering, because like a river, I change all the time, but I often hold on to thoughts or flows as permanent things. So the second noble truth of Buddha states that there is an origin of suffering, and that the origin of suffering is attachment to several kinds of desires, all of which wants to make me a permanent and everlasting thing, first in my body, so I'll last through life, and then in my soul, so I'll last in some afterlife, thinking somehow that this Mark is going to last forever and ever. Making this sense of myself, a self that lasts forever, is suffering. Thanks for hanging in with me on this Buddhist explanation that lies adjacent to this Taoist teaching on desires. For when we desire things, just plainly put, we are insecure with our being transitional selves. And we develop these false desires that we think will stop the flow and make things permanent. And we think that we'll live longer this way, live better, and even happier. Thomas Messenger puts it the following way. Nobody has ever been or had a self. First, our brains generate a world simulation so perfect that we do not recognize it as an image in our minds. Then, our brains generate an inner image of ourselves as a whole. This quote comes from his book called The Ego Tunnel, The Science of the Mind and the Myth of the Self. Can you say Matrix, the movie? So when we desire, we create this kernel of a sense of self that feels its need for something that it doesn't need. This kernel grows, seed-like, and becomes soon an almost unmanageable weed, one that masquerades our reality and camouflages itself as somehow necessary and permanent. Mismanaged desires, unskilled actions, all leading to a sense of self that temporarily thirsts for what does not satisfy. Which is all a way of saying that acquiring objects and things mindlessly is a settling of our real identity for something it is not made for. Settling, lowering our ceilings, diminishing the views of our real self. A never-ending spiral down, unless we end it ourselves. Developed desires become the traps and the snares we leave for our future selves. For when we try to become someone permanent by giving in to temporary passions and delights and thirst, we develop unnatural clingy thirsts and temporary sticky cravings, all in this vain attempt to look for the self in all the wrong places, that is, in things and ideas and notions that have no life in themselves.
The cultivation and expansion of needs is the antithesis of wisdom. It is also the antithesis of freedom and peace. Every increase in needs tends to increase one's dependence on outside forces over which one cannot have control, and therefore increases existential fear. Only by a reduction of needs can one promote a genuine reduction in those tensions which are the ultimate causes of strife and war. E.F. Schumacher, Small is Beautiful.
This sensibility of Schumacher is echoed by one of the first translators of Tao Te Ching into English, James Legge, who paraphrased part of verse 44 this way: "Who cleaves to fame rejects what is more great. Who loves large stores or goods gives up the richer state." This quote by Legge is a perfect description of opportunity costs. So let's think of nature. Do you know of an animal or plant besides us humans that hoard things? Not hoard things to survive a winter like a squirrel, but just gathers more and more, needing multiple dwellings to store it all. Do you know of some other animal or plant that would amass and hoard a useless pile of stuff it could never use? The 6 or so richest Americans' wealth is equal to 13 individual states' GDPs. When a rich person, household names mind you, makes in seconds what most of us earn in 1 year, is there something wrong with that? Which raises this very human question: how would anyone ever know when enough is enough? Imagine living a life where one never knows when enough is also adequate.
When you're listening, when you're listening, are you listening? When you're listening, when you're listening, are you listening?
I used to, and I still do, dream about some item to buy, some article of clothing, some electronic shiny thing. And so I scrimp and I save and I dream about my life with that article or thing. And then comes the day I actually buy it, and within a few moments, I'm off again to the internet, looking for something else to stuff my life with to ease both the craving and also to maintain the craving habit. The solution is to study how one develops craving and thirst for things. Let's get curious about that, which is our homework. Please develop and follow your curiosity about some habit of craving or thirst that you may have developed. Once upon a time, that thirst was not there, and now it is. Get curious about who you were before, and then after that craving began and you gave in to that craving. And then if you wish, you can get curious still more about ways to grow tired of this craving and quench this thirst for that which does not satisfy. Many spiritualities teach that we suffer in proportion to the degree we hang on to the wrong things. The wiser path to wisdom is to acknowledge them and expose the actual source of the pain. What is pain? Pain is just the price we pay for pleasures that we feel will somehow satisfy us. All our world faiths agree. We come and we go. Paul Simon sings the same thing. We come and we go. So what favor does it do to us to amass and then lose, amass and then lose? Buddhism, a close relative of Taoism, teaches us that the more we own, the more we leave behind us a bad karma trail. And it's the bad karma that gets ever reborn and born again, even resurrected. Why? So that we might one day learn from our bad karma. Only bad karma gets reborn and reborn again, until we get it right.
When you're listening, when you're listening, are you listening? When you're listening.
So from a Taoist perspective, a contented person is a most radical and dangerous person. Why? She can be content in any situation. While in a popular culture, through advertisements and a million subliminal, seductive messages, would have her be not content. A contented person cannot be bought for a price, any price. This consciousness of being a contented misfit in a society that values people fitting in is perhaps the reason you've kept listening to this podcast so far. You're looking for something, for peace in this present life, and that is good.
To be able to separate oneself from all affections is the path of tranquility. Lu Huineng.
And now, with some construction noises on the Mars Hill University campus as a backdrop to our recording session, let's go to Rangsei's questions.
How would you go about explaining this theme to the unprivileged?
Rangsei, I'm so far gone in my privilege. This is so hard, and yet you've asked such an important question. Are you asking whether the rich or poor are happier? First of all, you're asking a person who is relatively rich. I'm in the top 1 or 2% of wealth distribution, even with my so-called modest income in America. So I have really no competence here. I am privileged, period. So for me to make a judgment about whether I can make the same claims as today's podcast episodes for the underprivileged is something I cannot do in all fairness. First, though, if health and well-being is a matter of money, then yes, people without health concerns are happier. And usually the richer nations have better health for its citizens. Wealth can eliminate so much misery. Some things that we own can help alleviate misery. There's a study in the August 2023 Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization that says that income is positively related to a nation's sense of well-being. But Rangsei, your question goes deeper. Does having more, to use your words, actually lead to a better spiritual state? Again, I can only respond in general terms, for I feel very uncomfortable in preaching to someone that they should give up material goods to feel more spiritually rich and right. And in general, society does scream at us to be certain ways. Usually these ways are not that healthy for individuals or for society at large. Just to pursue the so-called American dream means that we do so much destruction to the world environment. It will take several Earths just to fulfill the desires and yearnings of those of us engaged in the American dream today, which is an argument for me that my own desires do affect others. We should live simply, as the saying goes, so that others may simply live. The USA and other nations like it amass so much material to themselves in our search for material security that we make the rest of the world insecure. Just look at global warming. We're able to ignore the environmental refugees around the world because we are so far above the mess that we are making in the world. So we should model how to go against the grain of society first and clean up our own backyard first before we ask others to temper or to slow down their appetites. So I would not ask or explain to unprivileged people to adopt this theme. I would ask first my fellow materialists in the West to understand what our privilege is actually doing to the rest of the world, including people. That said, the spiritual teachers who practiced this notion, Jesus and Buddha and people like that, were actually part of the materially poor in their parts of the world. They chose paths of non-acquisition as part of their spiritual mission to model how to leave the rat race for more. Jesus, in Matthew chapter 19, says, "It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God." And then the Buddha, which is troubling, because the Buddha practiced and modeled a voluntary poverty amongst his disciples and community, but he also said this, that poverty is a form of suffering. And some poor, he said, will not be able to properly practice the Dharma because they'll all be so preoccupied to get their basic needs met that they will not have the free time to practice. So it's difficult to maintain basic spiritual precepts if one is really poor. Finally, my own hospice chaplaincy experience teaches me this. When people are actually dying, they shed so much of the needless in order to focus on their one task, dying well. So if dying people get to this mindset, do we not have a privilege to learn from them in our lives, here and now? So, Rangsang, my response is really mixed. Do you have any extra insight for us or corrections to what I said?
I really like the response, and it's A. I feel like a sense of belonging probably answer most of the questions about the privilege and the unprivileged. As a sense of belonging would satisfy one's own need of wanting to have more.
Thank you. That's a very necessary part, and I missed that. So thank you so much. Now, you have a second question.
My other question is, where do you find hope in the midst of a world that encourages consumerism?
Again, thank you for taking the time to ask these questions. Rangsang, I find hope everywhere. There's joy everywhere, but we close ourselves off to it. So I find hope in opening up to just joy and hope itself. There's an author named Rebecca Solnit who helps me a lot here. Her books, A Field Guide to Getting Lost and Hope in the Dark, have been my companions of late that teach me that there is hope even though things look dark. I also find hope in finding peers and friends among the misfits in life who misfit against all those expectations that society has for us. I'm talking about the many cells of people who unite against environmental overconsumption, who barter their things away without the use of money, who have a buy nothing mentality. I find people who volunteer their time and do not attach a price point for their services to be very hope inspiring. Now, we became consumer societies very late in history. The consumer narrative began, I think, with Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations in 1776. To quote an Atlantic article from 2016, it was in Smith's earlier work, 1759's The Theory of Moral Sentiments, that Smith put his finger on the social and psychological impulses that push people to accumulate objects and gadgets. People, he observed, were stuffing their pockets with, quote, little conveniences, unquote, and then buying coats with more pockets to carry even more. By themselves, tweezer cases, elaborate snuff boxes, and other baubles might not have much use, but Smith pointed out what mattered was that people looked at them as a means of happiness. It was in people's imaginations that these objects became part of some harmonious system and made the pleasures of wealth grand and beautiful and noble, unquote. Between the 15th and 18th centuries, the world of goods was expanding in dramatic and unprecedented ways. But it was not a phenomenon just confined to Europe. Even the late Ming Dynasty in China had a so-called golden age of commerce that brought so many things like porcelain cups and lacquerware and books. In Renaissance Italy, it was not just the palazzi of the elite, but the homes of regular artisans that were filling up with more and more clothing, furniture, tableware, paintings, musical instruments, and just more elaborate of everything. So if we are not at one time saddled with a consumerist society, maybe we could return to those days. But I am not that hopeful. I think we shall be forced to return to a pre-consumerist mentality because our small world cannot sustain everyone's huge appetites. And when we get forced, the super privileged will still arrogate their privileges and keep their lifestyles. So I have some hope, and then I don't have some hope. But my main hope lies with folks that model how owning stuff is so taxing, to use the word, so consuming, that they use their critical thinking to reshape their lifestyles, habits, and how they even raise their children. In a world so shaped by the lenses and mirrors of consumption, where everything is shaped, is seen, and shaped by the point of view of the consumer, I think we have hope that there could be other ways of seeing. So my hope lies with folks who use their privilege and their goods and their viewpoints and their minds for others, who become or who stay voluntarily modest, even poor, in their habits. But it all depends on critical thinking by misfits, those who go against the grain. My hope is found in the critical thinking by those who wonder what this single view of the consumer is doing to us all. To us all. For my consumer's habits affects negatively the poorest in Haiti, the disappearing Maldives islands, for example. So what I do affects a lot of people. My hope is that I can stop doing some things, owning stuff, acquiring stuff, so that others may live better. What do you think, Renzi? Do you think I have a point, or do you think it needs some correction?
I think that's a response that answered the question well. And it's a personal hope, and it's a communal hope to see better ways to live. And thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast this week and helping me with this. You've asked some hard questions, and they're not going to leave me very quickly. So thank you very, very much. This podcast is an original labor of love, designed, written, and co-produced by Minnie, whose central idea is that Tao Te Ching remains good news for the day. Tao still speaks. Thank you, Rangsei Chang, for your voice and questions. Thank you, Audrey Davis, for being our artist. Thank you, Molly Hartwell, who you donated your song, Put Your Roots Down, for us. Fortress Press still holds the copyright for quotations from my Tao Te Ching translation. May your days begin in peace and become thirstless fields in which we sow the seeds of radical hope.
When you're listening, are you listening?